This is WABF, and it's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomenosi, President of the Common Sense Campaign and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Spring Hill College. This program is brought to you by an anonymous donor and Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and in Malbus with the state-of-the-art car wash. And good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, good morning right back to you. This chilly morning, can you believe we've had spring-like weather, and now we're back to, you know, March comes in like a lion, it goes out like a lamb. We'll see how that goes. Well, listen, folks, I'm really glad to have one of our sponsors here today, Kevin Spriggs. You know, Kevin is an interesting individual. He's an entrepreneur. He's got all sorts of varied interests besides doing, you know, helping me with this show. But one of the things that Kevin is very interested in and is a student of is China. His wife is from Taiwan. He has a daughter giving birth in Taiwan. So Kevin has a very special interest in what's going on with China itself in general, and what they're doing in terms of putting so much pressure on Taiwan. So what I wanted to do this morning was not just talk about Taiwan, but bring Kevin in to talk about a whole range of things. So we'll do that in terms of Russia-Ukraine. We're going to look at this whole business with this bank collapse. Okay, I mean, Kevin has been involved with, you know, business for a whole long time, and he understands these things. So I think it'll be important to see how he looks at what's going on with this bank collapse, the Silicon Valley SVB Bank. Okay, I also want to talk to him about the Trump DeSantis thing, because one of the things that Kevin did last year, and he got this sign that says big picture of DeSantis and says, with DeSantis, you get Trump without the crazy. And I thought that Kevin just nailed it on that. He really did. So we want to talk about that. Kevin actually went to the DeSantis speech last Thursday in Birmingham. So we want to talk about that. Then I want to kind of talk a little bit about what went on last week with our welcome back rally in Montgomery. Mention a few things about some of the highlights of that and bounce them off Kevin to see what his take is on the politics associated with what we're doing with the grassroots movement. Then I want to kind of talk a little bit about what went on with Biden and his tax policy. I mean, Kevin's involved with, you know, energy. He delivers gasoline to us, okay? So what Biden and the feds have been doing has a direct impact on his business. So he follows this very carefully. And I think it's instructive for us to be able to hear from someone who is really dealing with the inflationary impact of energy, problems associated with the Biden Green Deal and all the rest of this stuff. We need to hear it from someone who's in the trenches with this and take heed of what Kevin is talking about in terms of the long-term effects of what they're trying to do and the insanity of trying to do something with all of these electric cars. And he and I have talked about this a lot, and I'm going to save that for the last part so you can hear how he thinks that it is really nuts what they're trying to do with all these electric cars and trying to, you know, find places to charge your car in, and who's going to get, you know, big money out of that. So we'll talk about all those things. So Kevin, welcome this morning. How's everything going for you?
Yeah, well, we're having good business with the spring break traffic is now coming to the Eastern Shore and to the beaches and all, and so the weather pattern has been very helpful this year. We've had relatively very pretty mild days, and actually this little rain was good to wash a lot of pollen down. I know there'll be a lot of people appreciating that, and just always have to remember, you know, you don't plant your potatoes until Easter because of, you know, like this morning and maybe tomorrow morning,
exactly,
you might get snapped with that little frost that'll knock them back down.
Well, it's certainly good to hear that business is good for you, because that means maybe I'll still continue to have the show, okay? All right, so let's get down to brass tacks here. Okay, let's talk about China. I know that we've had conversations about this. I've had Commander D. Cox here talking about it from the military strategic perspective. But What is your overall take in terms of Xi and China's, you know, basic strategic approach to the United States and the world? What do you see there?
Well, China, what a lot of people don't realize, because I get a lot of people say, oh, China's, you know, going to be, you know, they're the big bad wolf that's out there, that they're like all powerful, all know everything. And the truth is, if you look at the Chinese economy, their economy has got some very serious internal mm-hmm. problems. First of all, the zero COVID, they were one of the last countries in the world to let go of zero COVID. And that was not by choice. That was because the Chinese Communist Party realized they were going to lose control of the entire country.
Exactly. Yeah.
If they did not, go away from the zero COVID policy, because not only was it causing social unrest, but it was also destroying their trade-based economy.
Mm-hmm.
You had factory workers that, you know, somebody's got COVID, all of a sudden the workers just walk off and cause a plant shutdown and a panic. And, you know, this whole idea that a government, whether it be totalitarian or supposedly free like ours, that you can just come in and shut down a modern industrial economy mm-hmm. and not face some very serious consequences. So this is where we are now. They finally let go of the zero COVID, and internally they've also have a real estate situation that dwarfs the real estate problems that we had in 2008,
mm-hmm.
and that is that their real estate is massively overbuilt and has created enormous debt internally with the municipalities, the tier one municipalities especially,
mm-hmm.
because real estate and real estate construction became a major revenue source for these municipalities to sustain their government operations. And so now they've got a debt and real estate crisis that, you know, the central government is going to have to try to unwind.
Yeah.
And this approach of can they make additional loans? Well, additional loans can patch a problem, but the underlying problem is still there. And,
right.
And sooner or later, there has to be a day of reckoning on real estate values and trying to sustain those values. So China has these enormous economic problems that you never hear about in the media. All you hear about is, oh, Chinese balloons spying on somebody. Oh, China might invade Taiwan. Oh, China might, you know, harass its neighbors. But I want to, you know, a question I like to ask people, you know, especially compared to what we see going on with Russia and Ukraine, I says, how many times has China actually invaded its neighbors in the last 200 years? And, you know, you say, well, there was an incursion in Vietnam back in the 70s.
Well, Tibet in 59.
And of course, the communist takeover in 49. But when you go back to the 40s and 50s, when we had the Korea conflict, you know, what you say with Tibet, you know, guess who was driving all that?
Well, the Russians
were. The Russians were.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hear all this talk about China, China, China. And meanwhile, I look at the history of my lifetime. It's the Soviet Union, Russia, that had, you know, thousands of nuclear missiles pointed at us. Funded, from Korea to Vietnam, all this revolutionary activity across the continent of Africa. And then even in our own hemisphere, it was Russians helping the Cubans, the Nicaraguans,
right.
And then, you know, in El Salvador. And finally, when we got a president, Ronald Reagan said enough was enough, then some of that got curtailed. But still, even since, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia has still been out there invading its neighbors, sending troops into Syria, meddling in Iraq, perhaps even
right.
funding the Taliban in some way in Afghanistan. So who's the real world problem right here? Is it China selling us cheap crap at Walmart, or is it the Russians that are actually out there killing people?
I would say, though, that the Chinese, I don't disagree with the idea that the Soviet Union really was the prime antagonist, okay? And one thing that helped us in that was that there was the Sino-Soviet split, and that, that and they had their own problems. I mean, Mao was trying to, you know, change things, and that created major problems in the 50s with, you know, the industrialization approach that he took. Okay, lots of people were hurt with that. And then he went through the great revolutionary period in the 60s where he purged all of the Communist Party, and it was really kind of an insane thing, but nevertheless that happened. So China had all those kind of internal issues to worry about. Obviously they were on the border with Vietnam, and they actually did send Chinese, you know, laborers to help the Vietnamese. But that quickly went apart, too, because it was really interesting. In 1969, the Soviets had an incursion on the Yuri River that they just bloodied the Chinese army. And that was a critical factor in terms of moving Chou Enlai, who was the foreign minister, to reach out to Kissinger and Nixon, because they were afraid of the Soviet Union. And I would argue at this point that whole thing has been reversed. You don't have those, you know, 18 or so divisions on that Chinese border anymore. They have become more friendly. I don't think that that's in our interest, but I do think that the relationship has completely flipped over now. And I want you to just kind of talk about that in terms of now Russia is almost a vassal state to China in terms of their the Chinese need Russian oil and energy, but the Russians need that market to sustain what they're doing.
Right. Well, you know, when you have a multi-thousand mile border with your neighbor, of course you have to, you know, relations have to be, you know, handled. There has to be an equilibrium there.
Yeah.
And China definitely has been a benefactor of raw material from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But China has also made investments across the world to help develop and to feed their industrial machine with raw materials and economics. And so, you know, I'm not saying that they're good guys, that's not the type of society I want to ever live in.
Right.
But as far as, you know, compared to the Russians, as far as intervening and being, military advisors and just being openly aggressive, you know, on the world stage. Economics, yes, they're good business people. They're smart business people.
Right.
They have developed as a economy, and they are the number two economy, and will eventually be the number one economy in the world. But because, look, they got four times our population.
Right.
I mean, so, you know, but having that, the internal economic problems that China has now. To me, it's like, you know, you don't want to take chances in disrupting business when you're trying to rebuild business. And that's what I see now, and it just bugs me, that because we get all upset by a balloon. You know, come on, give me a break. I mean, if you want to monitor communications out of a military base, we'll just rent you a white van and park outside the gate and point it. You know, I mean, it's not, to me, the balloon thing was, it just really exposed a weakness in our national security in that we missed. It showed
we
a
either
hole.
Missed it, or when we found out, they didn't do anything about it
later. The whole process of, well, we missed it, but now we found out, but now our mechanism to respond was obviously, you know, chaotic.
Yeah.
And so that's something that we got to fix. But to think that, China's the new boogerman,
the 800-pound gorilla
on the playing field. I said, no, we still got the same old guys that are the bad problems. We still got Iran. We still got Russia.
North you have the old axis of evil,
and that's it.
But you see, I think this is where I think maybe we may disagree a little bit about this, because I see the Belt and Road approach that they have it's not the same way that the Soviets did by funding revolutionary groups to overturn things. But in the end, they're gaining control over these countries because they're in debt to them. The countries, mm-hmm. they want a port. There was a port in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. I think, okay? So the Chinese go in, build a port, they own it. Okay, it's that mm-hmm. sort of thing, which is, and it's happening in my understanding in Latin America, to the point where there's real growth in their influence. Okay, so we know that great powers want to do these kinds of things. So I guess to your point, how long can they sustain the Belt and Road approach if they're having these internal economic things? So I think that probably is to our advantage about that. We just see, I mean, if they're having internal issues with their municipalities, and I think I mentioned that a few weeks ago when Deke was on, that you have this internal problem, then what is it, you know, if they can't sustain the municipalities, how in the world are they going to sustain this Belt and Road business?
Well, it's true, but we have been down this road of loaning money to the developing world, mm. and oh, it's going to help them, you know, build their economy.
We got to fight communism this way.
And yeah, we'll have influence with these nations, and then 5-10 years down the road, you know, banks made loans, and now they're having to write them off because they can't pay back the loans because the money that was supposed to develop was actually stolen and just,
right.
you know,
exactly.
burned up and wasted. And this is happening with the Belt and Road Initiative. Many of the investments they have made in Africa and yeah. now, you know, South America, mainly for economic development purposes so that they could get raw materials that, you know, the electric car industry needs.
Oh, or, right.
Or all the other, you know, manufacturing supplies that are needed. But then you come to find out, well, you know, this money that we loaned to them, now they can't get paid back because it didn't, you know, didn't turn out as
yeah.
profitable as it was thought to be. So it's a lot different. If China were, say, helping a country in Central America, and then all of a sudden Chinese missiles start showing up like they were,
right.
like in Cuba in the 1960s,
yeah.
but that's not what China does. They build a port. Now they want first rights to raw materials coming through that port, or maybe they want to import. You know, they want to actually sell something to that country that they don't have. To me, that's economics, and it's economic competition.
Yeah.
And we should look at our own economy to figure out how do we compete. You know, what are the inefficiencies in our economy, you know, with regulation, tax policy,
right.
and, you know, this attitude that if a company is successful, well, they had to cheat somebody to become successful. That's the problem that we have, that are interfering with our ability to compete against China and other countries around the world to be competitive. It's a lot different than when you're, you know, selling, you know, tanks, missiles, and now the advisors show up. This is the Russian strategy, okay?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, let's, you know, we want influence in the country. We'll sell them, you know,
yeah,
fighter jets.
Yeah.
And then we'll give you advisors to be there, and then, you know, later on, you know, you find out that, well, American missile strike takes out a jihadi base, and, oh, it killed so many Russian advisors. Well, what were they doing there in the first place? But that's the Russian model
yeah.
of world influence and power versus the Chinese model is, hey, we want to do business. Can we invest in this? Can we buy that? And you know, it's I'm not saying it's always necessarily a good thing, and we do need to be mindful of what our trade and economic policies are. But, you know, what I really see happening here, Dr. Liu, is we're talking about budget cuts in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the national security state has grown since 2001,
right.
and no one wants their budget cut because they're really important. And so we need this bugaboo to scare everybody that,
yeah.
oh, China's going to take over everything. You know, give us more money and that won't happen.
Well, before we get off China, and we won't go down that rabbit hole right there, let's talk, though, about the fact that so much of our economy is dependent upon Chinese goods coming here. Particularly, we found out during the COVID that the pharmaceuticals are all coming from China. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, my view is that we should be becoming less dependent upon China. I know that Kevin McCarthy, the new speaker, has a select committee on Chinese policy, and they're working towards doing that. I mean, and here again, I think the underlying argument, aside from the fact that many people see China as a threat, okay, well, but let's just hold that off for a second. The other underlying argument is that if you look carefully, and this has been, I would argue, a consistent theme of criticism on what's happening. We can't compete with China in terms of labor prices because they use unfair labor practices. They use slave labor to produce things. And so the whole idea that the World Trade Organization, they never should have been let in there because they're not playing by the same standards. I mean, what's your sense of that one?
Well, this a lot of these things are true.
Yeah.
That you know, policies, especially trade policies. I remember watching a 60 Minutes piece about Harley Davidson's being sold inside of China, and they cost mm-hmm. three times more than what they cost in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wrong. And that's where we need to be negotiating and putting pressure on China,
right? Like Trump did.
To, hey, you know, this trade is a great thing. We've been a benefactor of that, and in fact, I would argue to you that one of the reasons that we have gotten away with the amount of deficit spending that we've had in the past decade,
mm-hmm.
without experiencing really terrible inflation, is that because productivity and the available of cheap imports from China has kept the economy supplied, because mm-hmm. a lot of people forget, you know, in terms of the economic models, is that, yeah, government prints too much money, that causes inflation, but also there's the supply side of that is if you have adequate supplies in the economy, that also tends to moderate inflation.
Right.
And then, of course, the thing that we never really do to curtail inflation is cut government spending. Everybody talks about raising interest rates. Well, that's interest rates will, you know, curtail right. inflation. But you can, there's other ways to pull money out of the economy besides cutting government, I mean, besides inflation. I mean, interest rates.
Yeah.
You can reduce government spending. That's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
When the economy becomes, you know,
but politically, it's almost impossible.
Yeah,
to
so
do
that doesn't
that.
Get
That's
done.
That's the third rail of politics.
Then, when you have China and other countries are providing us with low cost, you know,
goods.
Supplies
mm-hmm.
into our economy, and now you want to cut that off. And basically, what happened that along with the federal government dumping money in the economy, but at the same time, the zero COVID policy in China was destroying their economy. And so the availability of those low-cost goods to our economy was starting to get constrained. Remember
yeah.
supply chain issues? Remember all that?
Sure.
That's
big,
that
boats
was
sitting off of Los Angeles unloaded.
Unloaded, and then being able to get things produced in China reliably, that all was under threat with the zero COVID policy.
Well, there seems to be a real push on the part of McCarthy and others to find a way to have business find alternative sources, okay? And like my understanding is Tesla, didn't Elon Musk take some of his folks out of China, and others are starting to do that too? Is that what you're seeing?
Well, Tesla in China is one of the first American companies
that went there.
What I'm going to say is actually owns their assets in China. They were permitted to actually own the factory without having to have a local partner.
Mm-hmm.
And they have developed a lot of the manufacturing technology in China, but they've also been able to bring that back to the United States as well.
Yeah.
And are about to take that. I mean, they've also built plants in Germany. and now there's going to be a plant in Mexico. So in that case, you know, you wonder, well, why did the Chinese government let them do that? You know, well, if you want to be successful in manufacturing, you've got to get out of the way of the people that know what they're doing. And I feel like in this country, we still haven't got there yet. You know, we still have a lot of government intervention at all levels.
But that's part and parcel of what the Democrats have sold to too many people, that it's business that's the problem. It's interesting how the Democrats have kind of flipped on that, in terms of they love big business now because they're getting all the dinero from them. But in the ideological argument is still there, that it's business that's the problem. And so Biden has instituted all these regulations. And to me, the most damaging thing that he did was to take away the energy independence that Trump had set us up for. And that created the supply issues, which filtered throughout the economy. So when you take on top of everything else that's going on, you know, well, then if there's not going to be a decrease in federal spending, which there isn't now, I mean, they're going to negotiate this. I heard McCarthy on TV Sunday. They're negotiating with him. Well, what are they negotiating about? Biden wants to do all sorts of things, raising taxes. Business tax went from 21 up to 28, and he has the audacity to whisper in the, you know how he does his little whisper thing, that this is what Reagan did. Okay, maybe Reagan had a 28. It's not relevant. It's where the rest of the world is, and Trump understood that. We wanted to make our business, you know, relevant and competitive. At 21, you are, and maybe you could have even cut it lower. We can argue about that, but the point is, for him to say, well, I'm doing just like Reagan did, who cares? Reagan's not here. The world has changed, you know? So we get back into this whole business of the socialist grip on the ideological approach to dealing with the economy that the Democrats have embraced. Mm. And it's, I mean, if you really want to get down to it, I mean, it's destructive. And if they are able to continue this for 4 years, and more years after that, then capitalism in this country is going to just be wrung out, and we're going to be just like any other banana republic.
Well, and the Democrats tend to use the emotional issues to scare people and get votes, okay? Like, well, you know, racism is the real cause of why, you know, you're not successful.
Right.
Or you're discriminated against, and so they create these monsters that feed off of emotions, and then what they don't understand is that sooner or later the monster doesn't pick who he eats; he eats everybody. Okay,
yeah.
and we've seen that with this Me Too movement, where the only way to get ahead as a woman is you got to, you know, do some kind of sexual favors or something, and you're all the time harassed and underpaid or whatever. And then guess what? Who's getting taken down by Me Too? It's big name Hollywood Democrats.
Right. Epstein and all the rest of them.
And what I've told people all along is, look, it's really the conservatives that have always honored and treated women
right
fairly and
on a pedestal
and respect your mother, you know,
right,
and want the best for your daughters. And it was Hollywood and the Democrats that were all the time debasing the culture,
right,
exploiting women for their sexuality,
right,
and
I mean the porn industry is not by accident.
making millions of dollars, billions of dollars in some cases, building large entertainment companies based on that. And then now all of a sudden they gin up this Me Too movement, and guess who they go eat? They go eat that.
Their own.
They eat their own. Yeah.
Well, I think that this discussion of China and all like that is certainly something that we have to keep in mind, okay? And I think that the question of Taiwan does present major issues, because for far too long the Kissinger-Nixon approach was, you know, there's Taiwan, but there's just one China. All of a sudden, the reality is that Taiwan doesn't necessarily want to be part of China. They want to remain independent. My understanding is the next election, the guy who's going to win, or Gao, whoever it was, is much more aggressive in terms of making sure that Taiwan remains independent. And of course, you've got Xi and them seeing that that independence is a major threat, and they reject the idea that Taiwan is independent. So you have the seeds there for an ongoing issue that, again, we saw with Nancy Pelosi's visit, what that triggered, okay? So what is your sense then in terms of, again, you've got relationships there, your wife has relationships. How does this all play itself out in terms of what your family sees going on out there and what you're thinking about it?
Well, you know, with respect to the Taiwan-China issue is really, if you look at it closely, nothing has changed. It has been like this since 1949.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's always a need for dictators to create an external threat to push, you know, say,
sure,
hey,
distract
you know,
them.
The reason my totalitarian economic policies are not working is because of that, you know, wolf or thing hiding
what
in the bushes over
there.
They're the reason. And don't look at what we're doing here at home that might be bad economic policy, like building too much real estate or building roads and bridges that don't make a return on your investment to your economy.
Yeah.
You know, so-called, you know, roads to nowhere, bridges to nowhere.
The Huey Long Bridge across the Mississippi River.
It employs people, you know, when we build that bridge, but you need to have, that bridge needs to have a return on its investment. In other words, it needs to make the economy function better. But when you build really beautiful world record bridges, but yet no one drives on them,
then
you realize you just wasted that money.
Yeah.
Or you build a high-speed rail that nobody in the country can afford the ticket price.
Right.
That's happened in China. And so there's always these stresses internally, but the economic situation is really the best defense strategy that we have with Taiwan. Because given the internal problems that China has right now with its economy, is why would you do something to jeopardize world trade, you know, where to the point where you can't sell your manufacturing goods or trade with the world? And that's why it was so important, I think, the reaction to Russia invading Ukraine and then the economic response to that.
The sanctions.
The sanctions and just the who wants to go do business in Russia right now? Who is crazy enough to go invest in Russia right now? And China needs foreign investment. And what people also don't understand is that a lot of the, especially in the electronics and semiconductor business, is those were Taiwanese business people that were operating and helping to build those plants inside of China because of the common language and somewhat common cultural, you know, background there. And when I've talked to business people in Taiwan, this unification to them is it's just irrelevant as long as trade is good, because the trade is what makes, you know, it employs people, makes people wealthier when there's cross-border trade and interaction. The contention or the stress of us versus them is in terms of Taiwan and China. That's what the politicians like, because politicians need emotions to get elected. It's hard to get elected as a politician based on your ideals.
Mo Brooks.
Mo Brooks.
Classic
example.
Very
conservative guy. You know, maybe not the best on making emotional connections with voters, but look at his voting record. He probably voted exactly the way you would have as a conservative if you were there, and yet, you know, cute little Katy Britt, oh, you know, Christian conservative, oh, that's who gets elected.
Yeah.
Okay. So did Katy Britt have that kind of voting record in Motorbrook? No. Did Katy Britt have multi-millions of dollars of funding from organizations outside of Alabama? Absolutely.
Well, I think that the complication for me with Taiwan is that the Xi himself understands that the existence of Taiwan, just like with Hong Kong, they could not allow Hong Kong to continue to go as a free, independent entity because the spillover was in Hong Kong. It's right there. They're linked. Okay, but in with Taiwan, there's the you know 12 miles of the strait, and so you can sort of that's a barrier. Okay, but it's only a partial barrier because, like you said, you've got people who have family on China. All whatever's going on in Taiwan influences a segment of what's going on in the opinion of people in China, I would argue, and so they become a threat, just like Hong Kong was a threat. So how do they deal with this? I mean, Xi keeps talking about this as, you know, reunification. Well, I mean, my understanding of the history of the place is that it never was part of China, okay? I mean, it was either Japan controlled it or, except particularly in the recent past. But the point is that as long as Xi sees this as an ideological threat, just like he saw Hong Kong, then what do you think we should do? Because I've said on the radio program, we need to deter the Chinese, and the only way to deter them is to make sure that they know that this two-China policy, you know, doesn't work anymore, that, you know, we're going to support Taiwan, and if necessary, my argument was to make it really a deterrent factor, we should be putting U.S. Marines there. My understanding, I heard somewhere that they are going to think about doing this, but I'm talking about doing something that is significant so that China knows that it will be a war if they try to do this. Now, is that in our interest? Well, that's an interest. That's a question that we can answer. My working assumption, it is, for a lot of different reasons. But so what is your sense, though, in terms of creating a deterrent effect so that China would not be tempted, along with the sanctions and all like that, which sometimes work, sometimes don't work?
Well, definitely Taiwan needs to be armed to the teeth.
Yeah.
So that, you know, a military incursion would be very costly.
My understanding is that we have like $19 billion worth of backlog of military equipment that hasn't been sent yet. I mean, this sounds like Biden, the same thing he did to Ukraine. He didn't give them the things they needed early enough to deter Putin.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is correct. It would be sad to find out that some of that military backlog is because parts from China have not mm-hmm. been delivered to defense contractors.
Right.
But at the same rate, it should be understood in diplomatic circles that that's not something that's going to be easy or cheap to accomplish as far as an incursion into Taiwan. But then after that, as you know, getting all upset about a balloon and you know, a lot of this emotional charging of the American public, I don't believe is helpful either, because it just makes us look like more of a threat when really the reality is we're dependent on them for a lot of things that we use in our economy. And so in terms of a two-China policy, the policy is Taiwan's off limits and we're going to arm them to the teeth, and we might even be there if necessary to help that. But at the same time, let's cool all this anti-China rhetoric about China's taking over the world, China's trying to invade everybody, China's doing this and that. And, you know, if there's opportunity for American business in China or Chinese businesses want to invest in the United States, that's an okay thing. Let's get more, you know, bilateral trade in place so that, you know, upsetting your customer becomes a very, you know, bad thing for you. You know, in other words, why do you know? You have to ask yourself if you were Ching, do you want to be like North Korea, or do you want to be like the rest of the world? You know, because I mean, dictatorship, that'll work. You know, just oppress people and point missiles and guns at everybody, and you can be in control, but you know, it's like being in control of the junkyard versus being in control of a nice section of
Key West.
Town.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think that you know these kinds of issues are part and parcel of what we're going through, and I think, you know, I appreciate your discussion on this, but we've already been in, and I noticed that I'm now down to 15 minutes, and Laurie's looking at the clock. So let's take a quick bite at Ukraine, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned last week that what I've seen developing is a soft anti-war approach to what's going on, okay? And even though, yes, I am a, you know, unreconstructed cold warrior, I kind of draw a line when it comes to, you know, the threat of a nuclear war over this, okay? My mm-hmm. argument is that before we go down that road, you know, we've got to make sure that we are doing whatever we can do in a conventional way to deal mm-hmm. with what Putin is attempting to do, okay? Which essentially means that I'm not at the point where I was, say, in the Cold War, okay, where better dead than red. I'm not there yet, okay? But I do think that Putin certainly is not capable of doing the kinds of damage that you would have saw during the Soviet Union Cold War period, except, you know, he could trigger a nuclear war simply by talking about, and we mentioned this, that one of his number two guys was talking about the towns in Poland, okay? You've got Russian nationals in Latvia and Estonia. I think 24, I made a correction on this. I thought it was 37%, but it's only in the 20s, high 20s, mid 20s, okay? But there's still Russian nationals there that are just like in the Donetsk area. So if the argument for Donetsk intervening there for Putin is Russian nationals are being oppressed, well, I mean, there they are in Estonia, but now those two countries are now in NATO. So it seems to me that we have got to be able to do something to send Putin a message that you can't do this, and if you start going into Latvia and Estonia, then you're going to meet U.S. forces. And I think we already have a group there. Hmm. But my point is that where does it rise to the same level as the Cold War? We've got to draw the line in the sand. You do this, and we're going to nuke you. I'm not there yet, but I do think that being conventionally strong over there would be a sufficient deterrent to where we wouldn't have to, you know, worry about a nuclear confrontation.
Well, Ukraine is the line, okay? Yeah. Russia has been intervening in their neighbors, all for the last 20 years, pretty much, ever since the Putin regime came to power. And what you have to look at, too, which to me is the most dangerous part of this situation, is the Russian nationalism that is being promoted and used to politically sustain Putin and his allies.
Yeah.
In other words, the Russian people are like, yeah, the West is morally bankrupt. They're telling kids to cut their penises off. They're not respecting women and their entertainment and all this.
Right.
There is
an anti-Christian approach here in the United States.
The anti-Christian activities where, you know, in the United States you can do whatever to a Catholic social services, you know, center. But if you touch an abortion clinic praying outside, you're going to jail. In Russia, there is a conservative Christian nationalistic movement,
right,
and it's being very heavily manipulated with Russian propaganda from Moscow throughout the countryside to say that these guys are evil, these guys are trying to take us over, Ukraine is full of Nazis, I mean you name it, they are using this nationalistic movement to justify and push this war. And the last thing that can happen, that we cannot let happen, is for Russian troops to go home successfully and have the same type of military parades that they had in Germany after the invasion of Poland, yeah. You know, to get the whole country turned into a massive, you know,
right.
war machine. And Russia has the resources, you know. Germany had the resources, too. Russia has the resources.
Yeah.
It's a matter of the politicians being able to manipulate the public and, you know, promote this war that, you know, if we just keep at it long enough, we're going to be successful. Now, the factors that work in our favor is that while your propaganda can say all this about Western civilization
yeah.
and Nazis in Ukraine, and you can say that all day long, but when people... Mothers send their...
Yeah, the body bags are coming back.
Mothers send their sons, and they don't come back.
Yeah.
And, well, what's wrong? I thought we were superior. Yeah. I thought we had the power and the ability. No, that message is the strongest message to the Russian public. And this nationalism about, well, Russia, look what we used to control. The old Soviet Union, we were, you know, we had half of Germany.
Well, this is Putin's.
And this
issue.
Is Putin's yeah. political machine. It's taken it, and it's tied directly in with the Russian nationalism, and they're using all the things the Germans did, you know,
right.
with propaganda and you know messages of you know superiority, and that cannot be allowed to be successful in Ukraine. I mean, if you want to have peace in the next 100 years. If you want to just, okay, well, let them have that. We know how that goes. Well, there's
yeah.
no satisfying a machine like that. That machine will get stronger and more powerful and will continue just to take the, you know, like if you don't like what's going on in Russia, well, guess what? You get a ticket to the front lines in Ukraine. You know,
right.
I mean, there's a part of this is in order for a dictatorship to control its population is you got to get rid of the people that could uprise and cause you problems. Well, if you take all the young disaffected people and send them to the front lines in Ukraine and they don't come back, well, you just got rid of some of your problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what's going on inside of Russia, and it's very important that we don't let that nationalism and that machinery of war become too strong
dominant,
to where
yeah.
we can't deal with it anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's, to me, it's like, well, what's the end point? Well, the end point is Russia gets out of Ukraine. Okay, we know what the territorial borders of Ukraine look like.
Right.
And so the end of the war is they get out and they stop invading their neighbors. Okay, I mean, that's, to me, is a very clear end point. Now, is there risk that the dictatorship will get, you know, get desperate and start using weapons of mass destruction, chemical,
well, if they get kicked out of the Donetsk area,
right.
then it is the
yeah,
rat is
I mean,
cornered.
Is yeah, does that, you know, is the dictatorship desperate enough to go that far? Hard to say, but if they are desperate enough to go that far, I mean, what's going to stop them anyway? I mean, where do you draw that line and stop them? You know, because the lines of the old Soviet Union cut through Germany and half of Europe.
Yeah,
okay.
And again, I guess my solution last week was territorial. You know, look, Ukraine has already been dismembered to a point because he took the Crimea. Okay, so that's kind of a bottom line issue right there. Now, do we give up the Russian nationalists, you know, who are in the eastern part, and dismember Ukraine, okay? For peace, based on the principle of self-determination, my argument last week was I think that that's something that should be contemplated, okay? If the western portion of Ukraine wants to be aligned with the EU and maybe NATO, then fine, let that be. Now, the danger here, though, is the working assumption is that Putin can be satisfied with the Donetsk region, or is he going to want Moldavia? Is he going to want, you know, to just gobble up Belarus, which, you know, is in his hip pocket anyway. And then what does he do with the Baltic states? So if you feed the beast, then you could be setting yourself up for something down the road, okay? But my argument at this point would be, see what happens if we can gain a peaceful solution along the lines of a territorial self-determination, knowing that if he crosses anything else, it's going to be a war. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's just, if you do that, okay, you get peace 5 years, 10 years.
And yeah, now, then what?
And now we're back to, oh, well, more interference. If you remember what Russia has done, and this is true like in Belarus and in Moldavia too, which are all in that region, Russian go in, they do have a minority Russian population in those countries. They use subversion techniques to capture the government through so-called democratic means.
Right.
And then it's, you know, oppression and dismantling of opposition.
Well, that happened in the Ukraine too.
That's how the beast gets bigger and stronger. And these techniques, you know, Russia's been doing this. And I would argue Soviet Union before was always like that. Well, here, let's go. You know, we got an uprising
The Hungarian tanks, they did that, and they suppressed it in Czechoslovakia in 68.
Exactly. There have been, you know, a Russian aggression really goes back even before the Second World War.
Right.
And, you know, in the Second World War, we ended the aggression of Japan. We ended the aggression of Germany, but we left Russia alone pretty much and helped them.
That's what I said last week. I mean, the Poles were the biggest losers of the war. I mean, 3 weeks after Germany attacked, the Russians came from the east, and the Russian-German pact was split in half. And then Stalin watched the SS destroy Warsaw, because when they did this in the summer of 44, they stopped on the Vistula River, they watched the SS destroy the Polish resistance, because they had their own government that they wanted to put in. This was the political sellout that Roosevelt knew was happening, his advisors told him about it, and he wouldn't cross it with Stalin. Churchill was opposed to all of this, you know, but and Patton was wonderful. He said, well, we got the American army here, let's go take care of the Ruskies.
Right.
You know,
I mean,
might have been right.
It was a choice that was made for peace, and it bought some time, okay? But if I look at the peace of my lifetime has been Americans having to spend billions of dollars on weapons and nuclear missiles and everything.
Yeah.
It's been having a lifetime of thousands of Russian missiles pointed at our country. And it's been, you know, wars that have been if not directly financed by Russia helping build opposition to us.
Right.
And basically Americans having to give their lives to contain this Russian aggression.
Right.
And so now here we are, you know, Russian aggression again with 20th century style warfare, which I thought, you know, maybe that was over, that countries could just, you know, blitzkrieg and take over.
Right.
But no,
well, he
Russia's,
certainly tried,
yeah,
but the
Russians
kind
to
of
do that.
Ran into a little problem there.
And they run into a problem in that they've tried to do that on a country that, you know, was very willing to fight back.
Well, Kevin, it is now 10:59, and Lori's giving me the thumbs up. Let's call it quits.
All right,
well, all right, folks. Well, listen, Kevin, I really appreciate you coming in today.
Good.
He still likes my show. All right. We might have another month.
You need to come in more often, Kevin.
More often.
Wow.
All right, folks. Listen,
we
covered China and Russia. Obviously, I didn't get nearly as close to my my outline as I wanted, but we'll pick up some of this next week. So you all have a great week. Hopefully, we're not going to have a month of cold weather here. Let's get back to that springtime and get those folks down to the beach. That's what we want. All right, y'all take care. Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much, Kevin Spriggs and Dr. Lou Campominosi. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review, brought to you by Spriggs Enterprises, which includes the Daphne gas stations on Highway 98 and in Malbus on 181 with the state-of-the-art car wash. This program is also sponsored by an anonymous donor. If you missed part of the program or want to tell a friend, you can listen to it later at WABF1480.com. Now resuming regular programming.